This is J.G. Hertzler, General Martok on Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Hello and welcome to Season 6, Episode 17 of Commentary, Trek Stars, a show which deals with the work of Star Trek creators outside of Star Trek. I'm Mike.
I'm John.
And today we're joined by our very special guest, Larry Nemechek, to begin our series on Michael Piller. How's it going, Larry?
It's going good. It's going good. We're all recovered from the Vegas Con this summer, and I'm glad to hear you were. I can't believe you waited this long to jump in on Michael Piller.
It's insane.
Thank you for having me.
I don't know how that happened, you know, but it was one of those things where, like, we got to the end now, and we were like, we better do this before we run out of episodes. So, today, we're starting a new series where we're going to be looking at his TV shows that he created, or the pilots for his TV shows that he created in particular. And today, we're going to be looking at his Star Trek stuff in general. And for those people who don't know, I don't know how you listen to this show and not know who Michael Piller is, but Michael Piller is the creator of, or co-creator of, Deep Space Nine and Voyager. He ran Next Generation for seasons 3 through 5, essentially, kind of, right? Before moving off to do Deep Space Nine. I mean, I know he was around.
He had his hand in, and he came back at the end. Not heavy-handedly. When it wrapped up, he made himself known. But right, yeah. hands on showrunner from third season on, and then kind of handed off to Jerry the last couple
of
years.
And he was pretty much hands on showrunner of Deep Space Nine for like seasons 1 through 2 and a half.
Yeah, one and two.
And then also Voyager along with Jerry Taylor for what, like 2 years?
First 2 years, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And then he came back to write Star Trek Insurrection.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, let's start at the very beginning. Season 3, or maybe just before Season 3. Now, Maurice Hurley was leaving, and we've talked all about Maurice Hurley in recent weeks, and he was leaving after the end of Season 2 of Next Generation, and there obviously needed to be a replacement. But Michael Piller wasn't originally that replacement, right?
Right. Michael Piller was actually doing a kid's show that was spacey called Hard Time on Planet Earth, and he'd had a writer. I was just kind of refreshing this. He had a writer come into him to pitch, and he was checking out. And I need to see who it was, because it's somebody who had sold a story on Next Gen, and he basically did a courtesy call over to the Next Gen office and talked to Maury that he'd also, you know, it's a small town. They kind of at least knew each other a little bit, and he just called to check up on this writer, and Maury said, "Hey, if you really care about it, I'm out of here at the end of the year. You should see about, you know, coming over." And he went, "Oh." So by the time he kind of got it together, they had already hired a guy named Michael Wagner to take Hurley's place as the showrunner. And even then, he and Michael Wagner reached out to each other, and he said, "Why don't you write a script for Next Gen," which was turned out to be Evolution with the Nanites. Yeah. And they co-wrote it because he did a polish on it. And by the time that process went along, and this is all like summer, right? This is like they come back to start shooting in July, and this is all happening in April and May, whatever. Well, by the time they were kind of partway through that script process, Michael Wagner had decided that it was not for him. And so Rick and Gene were kind of like desperate. You know, we need a showrunner, head writer. And not thinking anybody there, I guess apparently at the time, was who it should be handed off to. So they basically asked, you know, he happened to be the right guy at the right time who'd done a decent job, or more than decent job, on Evolution. And it was basically that script and that story that got him the job. They say, "Hey, look, he gets Star Trek." And he had been a sci-fi fan. We should say real quickly, he tells a famous story that he wanted to be a writer. He famously went to North Carolina, the powder blue one. And he was from New York originally. His mom and dad, his mom was a musician, his dad was a writer. His mom, Ruth Roberts, wrote the Mets song, Meet the Mets. He was a big baseball fan. Yeah. And Michael in baseball. And he had gone to college and had a writer, teacher, professor, who basically said, kind of like the paper chase, said, it's my job, there are enough bad writers out there, it's my job to weed you out before you waste your time and anybody else's. And basically kind of let Michael know, student Michael, college student Michael, know that he was one of those people that didn't have what it took and to get out. And it bothered him, and he started doing all kinds of sideball things and went back to New York. And he tells a story about he saw a chorus line the first or second week, and when the one girl does the song about... it's, hey, wait a minute, I'm good enough, it's not my fault. You know, get a better class, get a better teacher. And he went, there's other idiots out there that, you know. So he went in and got to class and started working on it. But in the meantime, he had been like a junior network suit, and he had been a censor, and then started writing and had credits on a lot of the 80s drama shows, and was showrunner on that Hard Time on Planet Earth, and then jumped into Trek, and... wound up being the guy that I say, there's probably four or five people you might say this of, but he was the guy that saved, one of the people that saved Star Trek, because, you know, Next Gen was kind of, it was wobbly. The production side was doing okay, but the writing side was still wobbly. It got off to a bad start. Now we're filling in all the blanks here with the Leonard Nimoy mess, the beginning, and then all the Maury Hurley turmoil the second year even. And there was still plenty of turmoil even in third season. But it was Michael that came in and put something on the rails and got it going, with and without his old friends like Ira Bear and people coming in to help. But that catches us up to what the situation was. They were so far behind starting third season of Next Gen. Those, you know, all the episodes? The Hunter, The High Ground, The Defector, you go down the line. That was all his, just like slap a name on it and get it out of here. And then we all kind of famously know that it sends the father in Yesterday's Enterprise, and a few before that showed some glimmers, but then they hit that strong suite and then ended up with Best of Both Worlds, and then the show took off and blam, and then Michael was, you know, Mr. Star Trek God for the next, you know, 5 or 6 years until he, I don't say burned out a little bit, but wanted to get back to some of his screenwriting. You know, he had enough money in the bank. He could go back to some of his screenwriting things. And then, and as you said, your series is going to wind up hitting Dead Zone. And he had some screenplays that he was working on, his development deal with Paramount also included. There was one, he had a spy thriller, a modern day spy thriller that he was, the name escapes me. So, you know, he liked his, you know, sci-fi, but Michael was not stuck in sci-fi world. He was a pretty competent, pretty guy, and not the most agrarious backslapping guy either, as he would say. He liked to come in early in the day, get his work done, and then go home and leave and have dinner with the family and the kids and Sandra, and that's the way he organized his day. He and Jerry were both that way, whereas a lot of the young boys, the Ron and Brandon and Renee and Noreen, all those guys, you know, they were the come in late in the morning and they had good work habits, but he was a get there at 5, 6, 7 in the morning guy and get it done early in the day kind of thing. So anyway, there's a little personality for you about Michael. He was a really interesting guy.
No,
loved his Dodgers. Saw great seats a few times. I'm not a huge baseball fan, but he would loan his tickets out to people, the assistants and the other writers and everybody at times. And the two times my dad came out to visit from Oklahoma, especially the first time. Neither one of us are big baseball people, but Michael gave us a couple of tickets for his seats right behind home plate, and I've got pictures of my dad and I, of all things, watching a Dodgers baseball game together, but it means a lot now, so.
Yeah, I mean, that's so crazy. I mean, I'm a huge baseball fan. Like, when I met Ira Steven Bear, I had him sign a baseball, you know, that kind of thing. But, you know, you hear that story about how, like, he took Ira Steven Bear to a baseball game to convince him to come back to do Deep Space Nine and everything. Mm-hmm. And ever since then, like, I've just had this image in my head of, like, these industry professionals, like, they're always at the Dodgers game, and anytime there's a Dodgers game on TV, which is rather frequently here, you know, I'm always like looking in the background for like filmmakers and stuff.
He collected baseball cards too. He had a toward the end of the, I think when he was going off his development deal, or when he went away from Trek and over across the street to his own office to do work on development, he had like a 2 or 3 month show at the LA County Natural History Museum with a little. I was going through. I found a new box of stuff. I should get scanned, but I found the invitation to the opening party for his baseball card show, which is
so cool.
Oh, wow.
Around 97 or something. He was so proud of that. Yeah,
he's like a sports nerd, you know.
Yeah,
yeah, that's cool. But
so hopefully that as we go forward, that sets a tone a little bit about what kind of a guy he was. And
you know. Yeah, you'd always see him. He every picture, he's always got a baseball cap on. I can relate to that.
Well, you know why? Because he was balding, and I mean, he talks about the idea for Insurrection coming from, you know, putting yet more Rogaine on his head, and thinking Fountain of Youth and all that. So yeah.
Well, that's cool. Wherever you take inspiration from, I guess.
Yeah.
I mean, it is kind of crazy, like thinking about it in today's world of like celebrity showrunners and the internet being what it is. I can only imagine if they were like, oh, yeah. Well, the guy who's taking over the writing staff for Star Trek is the showrunner of Hard Times on Planet Earth. I mean, I can just imagine the pitchforks. But back then, I guess no one really cared.
Well,
right?
I mean, he had sold. I need to see what he'd done. But he had several one-hour solid credits. I mean, he had a solid, you know, track record in drama.
Well, yeah, he was doing what, like Cagney and Lacey or something?
Yeah,
like
that? I want to say Simon. Yeah, I was going to say Simon. Oh. Yeah. Simon and a lot of good relationship buddy shows that, you know, the early days of relationship fanzine after Kirk Spock and, you know, K/Ed, not the necessarily homoerotic K/, but I mean the early fanzine people out of the 80s and 90s when there was no Star Trek around. Some of those buddy shows. What was the other one? Hardcastle and McCormick.
Oh, yeah.
Simon and Simon. There were the little hardcore zine world, the women of zine fandom, which they were 90% women. He wrote on several of those shows. Yeah, Cagney and Lacey, I want to say. Same thing, same kind of world where Jeri Taylor came from. Hers was, she did some of those in Quincy. She was a showrunner or a heavy contributor to Quincy, at least. But don't let the Disney thing, it was like the first time he got to showrun. So it's almost like he had solid writing credits and then he went back a step to be a showrunner on a Disney show, but he was showrunner now. It was like, you know, see what I'm saying? And then it's,
So, okay. One of the other things that you talked about, and this is kind of all related or whatever, but you know, you talked about sort of like the rocky road in season 3, and how it wasn't all, you know, good times.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's you know, that famous mass exodus of the writing staff and everything. And I know some of them
It's famous partly now because Ira came out and talked so honestly about it on the Blu-ray docs, which is a god's. I knew about that, but he really spelled, and they talked about it, but everybody was like, now don't put this, you know, don't do the nth degree. So it was good to see. That's what time going by does, you know.
yeah, for sure.
Statute of limitations runs out, and people feel a little more, just like with the first couple seasons in Shatner's Dock now on Next Gen and all that too.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
we know these things, you know.
And I mean, to me, like that stuff. I know that people are worried about protecting the brand and everything, but to me, it's like when I hear stories like that, I'm just sort of more in awe of the creative process. I'm more in awe of what they do, you know?
Yeah, it almost elevates it because you're like, well, how did they, you know, when they turn out something great, it's like easy to believe they turned out something great if everybody's happy and getting along. But then when they turn out something great and you find out, you know, it's like when you find out that your favorite band fought all the time. You're like, how did you guys turn out that album then?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's like I interviewed the showrunner for the Astronaut Wives Club, which is a great miniseries this summer, and it'll still be available online. It's 10 episodes, and it got better. It even got better as it went along. But I'm an old NASA kid, nerd, whatever. But part of the appeal of that is that glossy outward appeal, NASA PR look, and here's all this stuff. Not that they, not it was not the Real Housewives of Cocoa Beach or anything like that, or Houston, but they, you know, they did, and it was dramatized a little bit, but they did pretty much take the stories that was in the book, The Astronaut Wives Club, that the woman, Lily, I've gone blank on her name, interviewed a lot of the women before they died, and the original Mercury 7 wives and on into it. But all that to say that, I mean, you know, people are human beings, and it's, aside from the fact that it's boring, like you're making dramatic choices, they're human beings. And some days, you know, some days, what's that thing about some days the you get the cat and some days the cat gets you? What's that phrase? So, you know, some days things are rolling along great and some days things aren't. They're pretty bumpy. And that's just human existence and human experience. And there, you know, it's hard to imagine anything else that, especially today, pull that plug in five weeks, much less 13. But it's hard to imagine anything where the patience was shown Star Trek. But they were pioneering syndication, and it was Star Trek, and the cast was doing well, and the production looked good, although everything the first couple of years was getting better, and, you know, all the departments were doing better and better. The lighting turned over two or three times. And it was. They had those contracts about going 7 years, and the accountants had already pre-made the budgets where everything that made sense was predicated on going 7 years and all that, especially being syndicated. But it's hard to imagine them stumbling along for another two or three. You know, there were good shows. Measure of Man's a great show. There were some fun shows the first couple of years. But it just seemed like that evolution curve, like you give them a pass on the first season. Even today, you wouldn't get that pass, depending on what situation you were in. But even into the second season and still having it be, you know, bumpy shows, they were getting better. You could tell. I mean, the fans were so hungry. That was the thing. We weren't inundated with sci-fi, much less Trek. And we were all just so hungry watching it week to week back in those days that you cut them a lot of slack. And you were just like, any little sign of progress. So, yeah, for him to come in and be able to you know, jump on the bucking Bronco, even if he was sliding around the saddle, at least he didn't let go. Yeah. There's an image for you, you know, the gilly horse or something. He didn't let go, and other people got thrown off. And even as you know, even Iris said, I'm sorry, I'm just too beat up by this year. I have to go, and had to be taught back. And you know, like little boy Ron Moore, who was so thrilled to sell his spec script out of the blue, which was like, oh my God, they're sitting there in the office going, look at this, it's a script that's mostly ready. It's good. Get that kid in here and give him another script. Okay, hire that kid. You know. And he's there, and then the more experienced writers are all having their, you know, creative issues and whatever. And then but brick by brick, he starts to assemble his own staff. It's just amazing. But that's the year they wind up with Best of Both Worlds, and him not even knowing if he would come back because it had been a drain on him, you know, and that's where that. But just real quickly, I was finding some old quotes where he was talking about what he did. His thing from day one was Next Gen and Star Trek was a family. Not a family show, but that the characters were families, and he thought that Picard, even in Data, had been starting to get developed, but the entire rest of the cast had barely been touched. And one of the things he wanted to do right out of the gate was start developing the cast, and the first thing he did right out of the gate was to jump on Geordi, and that's why you had the enemy and the defector, or the enemy right off the bat, and the Leah booby trap right off the bat, third season. He started right in about developing the characters as family, as a unit and individuals. And even though it was a nightmare and they went through what was in the bone pile before they started taking, you know, and then Michael famously is the one that said, why are we ignoring the fan base out there? And he is the one that said, we'll come up with a release form if that's what it takes, but let's hear some of the fan writers. And they started, listening, you know, taking the spec scripts, which was just unheard of because they knew that if somebody sent a script and then a year later they bought an idea that was similar, then the kid sitting in Iowa would go, you ripped off my story, and take them to arbitration. And that's what the purpose of, and eventually that's what it brought it down. But 10 years later, whatever, that's what finally happened after Michael had passed or was out of the show running spot. But, you know, Michael did that, and he brought in all these young buck writers eventually, Ron and Renee and Ron Moore and Brandon Braga and Renee Echevarria and Naren Shankar and Joe Manosky and then even Brian Fuller and Ken Biller and even on the tail end of that Mike Sussman and some of the guys on the Voyager Enterprise years but that overlapped. But you know, I mean, his he had several gifts, and we should talk about the seasons here. I don't want to hijack the whole show, but Michael was just a pretty simple guy that just wanted to do a good job and really cared a lot about Star Trek, especially after he got into it, and was not afraid to fight Gene or fight Rick or fight his young buck writers or whatever. If he, you know, whatever his stature was or where he was in the pecking order, he would go to bat for things he believed in.
And yet he did try really hard, it seems, to fit inside that Roddenberry box, right? I mean, he was kind of known for working within the limitations which were presented to him and figuring out a way to make that formula work dramatically. I mean, would you say that that's an accurate statement? Or?
Well, yeah. Of course, there would be, you know, Gene, when he came, he knew Gene, and Gene was still going well, but within a year or two, Gene's health was going downhill. But, you know, third season, they were still arguing about whether they could mention Spock by name, you know, and Sarek. And fighting over, like Eric will tell you, his original idea for Yesterday's Enterprise was about Sarek going back to the Guardian. It was a Guardian of Forever show. And you know, the whole thing, it became Sela replacing herself to fix history, was about Sarek and changing history with the Guardian. But him, you know, I say he was a Trek fan. He appreciated it, but he wasn't a Ron Moore Trek fan. He wasn't like all the young kids coming up later. I mean, the original generation, Ira was probably the oldest fanboy of the writing corps there that had a professional resume. The rest of them were just getting started off as the boys, as Jerry used to call them. So, but he knew that something made Star Trek. You know, he was smart enough to go, let's tap the fan potential out there. And sure, 99% will be Drek. But hey, look, we got Ron Moore's script in, and he had to find a way to get it through. He had to leave it with somebody to get it to us to see. And we snapped it up and used it in a heartbeat. And they're not all going to be that. 1 out of 100 will do that, maybe. You know, and Rene Echevarria wound up being another one like that. But he, you know, give him credit for opening the door. And they wound up taking a lot of pitches. They may not have been usable scripts, but they took script ideas and then crafted it themselves. And sometimes if it was good enough, some people's, you know, name and money stayed with it, and sometimes it got taken off, but they got something. They got paid something for it. So that's that, yeah.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, hey, we got Ron Moore out of the deal, so that's not too bad.
Ron Moore and that whole string of guys I mentioned, you know.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Who are now show running shows and doing, you know,
everything. I mean, basically that list that you rattled off is like the people who are running TV now, right? I mean,
yeah.
It's kind of crazy.
I mean, Narain was a friend of Ron's, who and that's what Narendra 3 is named after. But he was the science advisor, but he wanted to write, and instead of going to Voyager at DS9 when Next Gen ended, he went off on his own, then wound up running CSI in its glory. Not the first couple of years, but like the glory 6, 7, 8 middle years of CSI.
Yeah, it's not too bad.
Which brought science to a mainstream audience. So, you know, and then all of them. So he's got a great legacy. And we barely talk about shows, but that's the stuff between the cracks that is the reason why then you see the final product, and you see his, you know, he has a hand in everything, where there's, like any of the showrunners, they all have a hand in every script, whether their name is formally in the credit or not, because they may do an uncredited rewrite and give a new writer or give somebody else more of the split on the money, you know, by not putting a name in the slot. So, but that's just their job. If you're a showrunner, that is your job to be the final polish or make sure it's done by somebody on staff. You're the, you know, the buck stops with you.
Yeah, yeah. It's your show, essentially, right?
So. Yeah.
All right. Well, okay. So, Next Gen, by season 4, it gets its shit together.
Yeah. And, it explodes.
Becomes what we all know and love. And after season 5, approximately, you know, simultaneously, but whatever, he leaves the show to develop Deep Space Nine. So
he steps back, we'll say.
He steps back. Okay. He steps back to develop Deep Space Nine. And I mean, I know that Berman was, you know, co-creator on that, but you know, it does definitely feel like Piller probably did the heavy lifting in terms of the writing in that equation.
Well, they can sit, they'd sit around and have, just like they did with Voyager, with Jerry involved too. They would sit around and conceptualize and have a lot of lunch meetings and, you know, yellow pad meetings and bash stuff out and bash stuff out. And then, yeah, when it came time to put words on paper, it was, that was his job. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, okay, well, I mean, let's talk about DS9 and what the decisions were that were made in order to, you know, sort of make this thing different from Next Gen, or decide that that's what was needed, you know? So, okay, so when was it that the network or whoever it was, I mean, I know there wasn't a network, but the studio, whatever it was, said, okay, we want a new Star Trek show?
Well, it was when the fourth season and the fifth season took off, and they wanted to overlap, and they saw a good thing, and it's that old Star Trek conundrum of whenever you have a new series, or even if you have a movie versus the movie before it, it's like, okay, we want exactly the same thing, only different.
Yeah,
yeah.
So it's like, what do you do? And I'm sure, you know, a lot of us have been through the whole pendulum swing of, okay, well, DS9's going to be the darker, grittier side, which is what they said at the time. You know, the Next Gen became the happy, bright family in space. We need to introduce conflict. How do you do that without interrupting the inner human perfection of the perfect humans of Gene's 24th century? We'll have the other species, whether they're allies or they're adversaries, and we'll put them at the, you know, the Casablanca or the Dodge City or the, you know, Fort whatever of the galaxy here at this crossing point, and then we opened up the wormhole as an entry point to that even more. So they threw all these ideas, and it was kind of the outpost on space, and they thought about having it be ground-based or on, you know, it's like, can it either be a space station, a ship, or be on a planet? And they thought the planet sets would be too expensive, and they just didn't want to do their ship show, so bang, space station was it. And I don't think they thought in the beginning that thing they hung around DS9's neck, if it's the show that doesn't go anywhere, they didn't think that was going to hit them until people started to say that. And then they, you know, they had the runabouts, and but it was a thing they felt their way along, and thank goodness they had a situation where they were allowed to do that. They were a golden calf, you know, golden child, and they were allowed to find their way through one season. And then they could look back and go, okay, well, it did seem, we went over budget on the pilot, which was an amazing pilot, and then we took it out on all the other shows. We're all kind of cramped and bottle showy, and so let's open up the second season with this big, you know, three-part Bajoran story, and let's get over that. And then by that time, they were into already thinking about Voyager and UPN. Although the UPN network angle came late, they were going to do another syndicated show to replace Next Gen. Jerry was talking about this on my Trekland on speaker CD that we had at Vegas, and it's all about Caretaker, the pilot for Voyager. And I was remembering how she said we went at it just thinking it was going to be the syndicated show to replace Next Gen, so we had two shows running. And then at the last second, UPN kind of became a thing and said, oh, well, let's do a Star Trek and you can be our flagship and yada yada, and it'll be a big deal. And all of a sudden Star Trek had a network show again. But so he backed off to go do that. And then when Voyager got going, he backed off, and somewhere in the mix, I just know because it affected our life, because it's how my wife got to work on Voyager for 5 years. But when Voyager was launched, he wanted to do, after all those years of Trek, he wanted to do something different under his deal, his writing deal, development deal, and he developed Legend for UPN with
Richard Dean Anderson.
Yeah, Richard Dean Anderson and John DeLancey, and which was a great show. It was cut off before its time, about the writer who wrote the Tall Tales of the West in the 1880s and 90s, but he wrote about what all he did, but he didn't really do it. And John DeLancey was kind of the wacky inventor that, it was kind of like a Wild Wild West a little bit, only instead of it being agents, it was a writer who was making tall tales out of, you know, writing much bigger than what real life was. And they would have a mystery or a crime or something, or an adventure to deal with every week. And it only went, you know, like 13 shows and got canceled early by UPN. Surprise, surprise. But if they had shown it the courtesy that they showed Star Trek, it could. They never marketed it right. They would never show John DeLancey in any of the I remember this. They never showed DeLancey. I'm like, the Trek audience, it followed Voyager, and they would never show DeLancey in any of the promos. It's like they would never show Jerry Ryan in the promos for Body of Proof. And I'm like, Is this somebody's ego somewhere, or contractual, or are you just stupid about your potential audience? You know, like, use everything. And then he came back to Voyager and kind of jumped back in after things had kind of gone with him being hands off. And then he was there through the end of the second season, and then totally got out to be a note writing creative consultant, and went over to develop movies and took Eric with him, and what became turned into Dead Zone and then Wildfire on ABC Family before the cancer came back to him. There's the whole end of it there, kind of in a nutshell.
Yeah, I mean it's crazy, like with the whole Legend thing, like that show debuted 3 months after Voyager debuted. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, they came one right after the other. I mean, that's pretty impressive, you know, for one person to create two shows in 3 months or whatever in terms of air date. That's crazy. But
shows you that Jerry was probably, since there were three of them co-creating Voyager, it was like Jerry kind of taking the lion's share of the fresh the fresh blood on that one. But yeah, but you say that, that's, Janet came in as a temp. When they were doing the pilot for Legend, she was temping while they were still casting Voyager in the whole Janeway casting crisis, and will the first officer and doctor be a male if it's a female captain, or will they be a female if it's a male captain thing. She was there with a front row seat with the casting office out her back window. So they were, but that reminds me that Legend was like right on the heels of Voyager. But again, I remember he had a party at his house to, you know, kick off Voyager, and everybody loved it. But I always thought he got done dirty by the UPN, by the crazy little UPN crazy execs who kept turning over every 2 years until, you know, Les Moonves basically grabbed it and then shut it down.
UPN was a very troubled network. I remember that much. They didn't seem to get anything going.
Really. Troubled, I mean, is a very dignified word adjective. Yeah.
They didn't give that show Pigsty the chance it deserved either, right?
Yeah, what's up with that?
Yeah.
I don't know. Yes, that's a crazy network, but to say the least, you know. But so Voyager, I mean, yeah, Deep Space Nine, it seems to make sense that, you know, kind of the same pattern would occur that occurred with the creation of Deep Space Nine when it came to Voyager, that he would step back from,
and I think him talking Ira back to DS9 wasn't just, oh, come help me get the show off the air. I think he from the beginning went, and when I back off in a couple of years, you're going to be the showrunner. I mean, I think that whether he told Ira that up front or not, and maybe he did, but I know that was in his mind, you know. Just
I mean, for him to have the foresight to say, like, you know, I know what's going to work, and I know that you know even when I leave, this guy is going to make, like, you know, one of the best television shows of all time. I mean, that's pretty impressive. How do you do that?
It's amazing how you just look for ways to work in Battlestar Galactica references. I'm honestly in
awe. Well, that was Deep Space
it.
Nine. That was a Deep Space Nine reference, right?
Okay,
there,
I'm sorry. You know. My mistake. I just that's immediately where my brain goes.
No, he did that when he bought the script for Ron Moore. He knew that one day this kid would go on to make the best television show. Yeah, I mean, it's pretty amazing. So he left, and we're going to talk about all of his shows, you know, in the coming weeks. But then he came back for Insurrection. Now, I mean, I guess this is kind of an interesting thing. I mean, it's sort of like a prelude to this, because this has always been something which has kind of bothered me. And, like, I know that he wasn't there for, like, the day-to-day operations at the end of Next Gen, but it seems strange to me that, like, he wouldn't have written the finale. I mean, it seems strange that Jerry Taylor didn't write the finale. I mean, how did, you know, Ron Moore and Brandon Braga end up with that gig? And, I mean, I guess I'm not really interested in that as I am, you know, like, how did Michael Piller end up not saying, I'm going to do this myself?
Let's look at the calendar. We're talking about 93-94 in the winter and the spring. Michael has been, if he's not, they're into the second year of DS9, so he's trying to get that, but they're already talking about Voyager. He's hit deep in getting Voyager off the ground. So he's not going to take the lion's share of the finale and the wrap-up of TNG, but he did jump in the last couple of shows and the finale. In fact, I dug this out because I always remember this. There's a very famous, and I've read it a couple times at conventions, and when I get Portal 47 going, my new fan experience deep dive thing, this is one of the things, the kind of thing we'll talk about. But basically, he jumped back in on the finale of Next Gen. There was a whole scene, instead of just asking Riker for the future D, they had a really cute scene where basically the entire senior staff in the future goes to the D in a, you know, in a ship museum with a tour guide, with a token tour guide. And this is not Michaels, this is Ron and Brannon, and wrote a really cute scene where they're basically taking a tour incognito, and old Picard is like, you know, Beverly's talking about my grandfather, and they're all there like this Scooby-Doo, you know, Muttley crew kind of thing, and the tour guides, and this was the throne, this was the seat of honor for Captain Jean-Luc Picard, and over here, the vaunted, you know, and she's doing a bridge tour, and they go to engineering, and she's telling them not to touch the consoles and all this stuff. And meanwhile, they're all going, they're having fun, but Data and Geordi are like, oh, look, there are some shards of dilithium still in the warp core. Okay. Well, you know, and the regenerator. Okay. And they go to, and then at the end of it, and Worf is on the tour too, and at the end of it, you know, like they pull a phaser on her and stick her in a closet, basically. But it was a really cute scene, and there's a memo that when he saw it, and it was late in the game because they were writing it insanely crazy late, and he basically said, guys, it's wonderful, but it's too cute. And he wrote this memo called the April in Paris moment memo, where basically he said, you guys, young Ron, young Brannon, on this amazing show, this thing, your career has just exploded. Look what's happened to you in the last 2, 3, 4. You know, Ron, you were waiting tables and sleeping on somebody's sofa. You know, Brannon, you were an intern, and here 2, 3 years later, you're writing the first modern Star Trek movie, and you're writing the finale for this hit show that got nominated for a drama series Emmy finally. And he's saying, you know, you need to think about the crew in the same terms as what's happening to you. And saying, you know, it's a little bit like what Ira got back to when he went on his there'll never be a time like, you know, what we left behind back at DS9 when they did their finale. But talking about, you know, the most important moment of our lives, this moment, and we missed it before we even realize that moment has passed us, with each of us even barely paying attention to it. And as we learn the lessons of this episode, he's talking about all good things, we come to understand that you can never have that moment again. You can revisit it, you can remember it, you can laugh about it, you can hold reunions, you can go to conventions, you can show reruns forever, but you can never live that moment again. If man is to evolve to the next level, he must learn to explore the moment, which gets into a lot of the Q stuff. But he was double doing that to them. And I just remember when I was interviewing, he said, I wrote a memo to Ron and Brannon. I'll get you a copy of that memo. When I was doing The Companion. And, you know, here's these young bucks, like all of them were doing, and they especially, who were all still very humble, but their careers were just exploding here for them and making choices. And here's slightly sadder but wiser, slightly older mentor, Mike Piller, you know, kind of saying, okay, guys, I know it's hard to do, but just take a moment and try to savor this while you're being hounded for movie revision pages at the same time you're writing the whole finale in a month under duress. And think of that. So maybe not have it be quite as sugar cakey, but maybe have that more permeate the finale. And that's what wound up happening. You know, yeah. Then you wind up with Picard coming into the poker game at the end, and then going, well, that was an interesting future we just saw, which was all written intentionally to be nothing at all like what you saw starting to happen in Generations, right? I mean, the D crash. So of course they're not going to be on the ship. Is not going to be in a museum 20 years from now or 10 years from now. It's going to be crashed, but. In fact, they intentionally tweaked all that stuff in All Good Things, you know, like Warp 13 and Three Nacelles and yada, yada. But that's what he kind of came back and infused. So, no, not a heavy-handed comeback at the end, but he kind of came back and said, let's get the – you young guys are brilliant, but let's kind of reset this focus and this point of view and this frame. And meanwhile, I'll get back to trying to get Voyager cranked out in time, much less Legend.
So, okay, so he was understandably busy, you know, and it sounds like TV was really his passion, at least at that point in time, or maybe just something that he saw as being, you know, an avenue for...
Yeah, well, those are the roads that were open in front. But, you know, the whole time he was, he had, you know, he's a writer. He had three or four or five movie scripts in a drawer somewhere in his back pocket, you know, that he could pull out and go and finish developing. Or somebody put some money into them and he could, you know, take off and go with it. And he of course he wanted to do that and diversify and, you know, things.
I guess I was just thinking more along the lines of, you know, the way that things are going or whatever. Okay, Deep Space Nine is going now, and then it's like, okay, there's going to be a movie,
oh,
and
a
there's
going to
be a new series, yeah, right?
And well, he did get, you know, the Generations famously was, they were hedging bets, Rick and Paramount, and they actually had Maury Hurley talk about coming back, mm-hmm, and then yeah. Rick and Brannon, Ron and Brannon doing a story treatment, and they picked Ron and Brannon's to run with, which was probably what they intended to do all along, but they just had Maury as a fallback.
Yeah.
And Michael said later on that Rick asked him, but he felt a little insulted to have to audition like an actor, you know?
Yeah.
So he's like, you know, as politely as he could, was kind of like, no thanks. Like, that's okay. Yeah. Like, if you want to come to me and have me write it, that's one thing, but I don't think I need to audition. So, you know, and then First Contact was, the guys were hot and they wanted to fix, you know, they wanted another shot at doing a great script, and they did. Even from separate shows, they came back and worked together just great. So when First Contact was over, and Ron and Brannon are kind of like, well, we don't want to do three Star Trek movies, you know, and where are they now? 98, you know, DS9. They're thinking on down the line on their career. And that's when Rick comes back to Michael and goes, okay, you know, here's your chance. I'm sorry. I want you to do the next one. And you've had some time away, maybe some fresh thoughts, maybe some distance, and so that's how they approached it. And Michael kind of looked at it as like, you know, I've got some things going here, and you know, Legend's gone. We're working on Dead Zone, kind of that famous movie or two that I can't remember the titles of, the spy movie especially. And he's like, okay, I think the time is right now to tackle this, and here's what I want to do. And the whole, you know, Heart of Darkness theme and a couple of the other darker things. I mean, First Contact was dark. I say dark, yeah, but he also wanted to make sure that it, you know, movies by themselves, people complain about the next gen movies, unlike the original series, which did the opposite. The series was like lead, second banana, or co-leads driven with the little five below, and they kept finding more ways for the original series cast to have more equal. Next gen was the opposite. They had the family, and then they all became Picard and Data, you know, action movies for billing purpose almost, and structure. And one of the things Michael brought to Insurrection out of the gate was, he says, I want the movie format to be the family again. I want everybody, which drove a lot of what they did. Now, is that book, is his book Fade to Black, is it online now? I mean, I've had a copy since he wrote it and didn't publish it, and I used it for the companion. And it's been back and forth.
I've read it. I don't know if I was supposed to, but
it's, well, I know Sandra wanted to get it out. It is okay. I thought it was pretty much out there. Like, who cares now? I never could figure out who would care. So you can read the whole bloody back and forth. You know, I always felt badly for Michael because his first instinct, he wanted to use Romulans with his story, and Patrick and Rick or whatever. Maybe I'm casting a wide net there, but some powers that be thought that Romulans were boring, in air quotes, which Michael was around long enough to see Nemesis start off with Romulans, and then even he didn't live to see it, but then JJ started off with a renegade Romulan. So if he could have done his original take as the book lays out, a lot of the machinations of writing what became Insurrection, you know, the movie didn't even have a name settled on until late in the process. A lot of that would, you know, if he'd been allowed just to sit down and write his thing without by then having the committee of powers that be and people with, say, you know, nitpick it to pieces at every turn, it might have been a whole different critter. And I always felt badly about that. And the last time I did a formal interview with him for the movie edition of Companion, we got to talk, you know, in 02 or something, we got to talk, and he did one of those, I said, well, how interesting it was that you wanted to do Romulans and they were boring, but here the next two, you know, the next movie started off with Romulans. And he did one of those, how about that, huh? You know, looks at
me. Yeah. You know, I mean, it is a great book. And I think yeah, like you're saying, the thing that it shows more than anything is sort of how the creative process works on a movie of this scale, you know, and
especially what, a franchise movie.
Sure. Yeah. And by that, yeah. I mean, like, they have, like, you know, budget breakdowns and stuff, and it's crazy and awesome. I mean, it's just, it's very eye-opening to see, and really sort of, you know, makes you think about, like, what the story is behind the credits that you're seeing, and maybe not placing blame on people mm-hmm. just because they happen to be, you know, up there on the screen. You know, their names happen to be up there on the screen.
He didn't direct it, and he didn't, you know, have say and sway over all the people he had to make. I mean, I think of all the, I don't want to be too generalized here, but of all the next gen movies, it may have been the most political. Political, not in factions around the world, but as in the people that had a hand in the too many cooks in the kitchen.
Sure, I mean, you had Patrick Stewart as a producer and everything like that, and it's like, yeah, it you can totally tell. You can totally tell.
Yeah, which is like that's what happened. You go to a movie franchise, and people, how do you negotiate? You know, somebody's agent. You have to put more perks in. So this time we're going to give you a better image approval on photography. We're going to give you the right to do notes on, you know, I mean, those are like little perks that go into contracts because it's the fourth movie now and the third movie, and you should have more than you had on the first movie, and or else your life is not moving forward. You know, kind of just mm-hmm. goofy stuff that in hindsight you kind of go, yeah. But at the time, that's part of the climbing the ladder, and that's part of the, you know, that's part of the scene.
Yeah,
so yeah. And the attitude of the time of Paramount was like slap a director on it, but it's like it's a Star Trek movie. How do you mess that up? You know, mm-hmm. which if it didn't get answered, then we sure had the answer with Nemesis. But
yes.
I mean, but on a personal level, I just always felt badly for Michael that his big comeback to Trek wound up becoming this octopus kind of a creative creature.
You know it. It sucks, but at the same time, I mean, the fact that book is out there as sort of like the final exclamation point on his legacy, I think is kind of awesome, you know?
I don't think he knew that when he sat down to write it, but I think after it all happened, I think that's why he was really into, and the fact that one producer at Paramount held it up.
Yeah.
Not because of anything that was said, but it was just a blanket thing of we shouldn't show the world how we. This is pre-internet.
Yeah.
This is pre-24/7 media, blogtastic world that we live in. You know, Podorama. But it was kind of like we shouldn't show the world how these like meetings, what's said in these meetings, and the kind of decisions we make. It was all about like showing too much process. It wasn't even like about any specific. And then for years and years and years, nobody would, well, somebody didn't want to publish it. It wasn't for cause at all. And after a few years, all those, you know, after the big Paramount turnover and after the big Viacom divorce, none of those people were, nobody involved was involved anymore. And it was like, why isn't it? And Sandra, Michael's widow, has been wanting to get it out. I mean, I think she'd rather have it out legitimately and, you know, have it out for sale. If it's going to be out there as a PDF that people download or whatever, so be it. But yeah, but whatever happened, Michael wanted that to be his, you know, not so much as don't blame me, but his like, can you believe what I had to deal with? Here's the true story, what really happened. And not as an excuse, but just to show, you know, here's my, if you liked my original ideas or you didn't like them, fine, but here's what it was, you know.
I mean, it's the thing that, I mean, we're all sort of chasing, you know? I mean, I know, I would say it's probably the thing that you've been chasing throughout, like, all the stuff that you've done, which is, like, trying to pull back the curtain and show how this stuff is made, right?
Yeah, and preserve it. Yeah.
How we get the art that we're watching, and I think that's pretty awesome, you know?
And context in between facts.
Not a
day goes by that I don't see somebody or hear somebody talking, and they're, oh, yeah, well, somebody, I go, no, it was this. And not that the world's going to stop spinning over it, but yeah.
It helps you appreciate everything more, you know? And not just Insurrection, but everything, like all movies, you know? I mean, it's pretty awesome. It's a pretty awesome book.
Some smart aleck is going to go, well, that was, I mean, you do have to remember, when you read that was like 1997, 98. So yeah. it's the way they were doing, you know, Paramount and tentpole and Trek movies in 1997-98. So a lot of things have changed, but then, you know, the thing that's never different is when there's pressure to either follow up a sequel or in a franchise series or whatever. I mean, you look at any series and everybody enjoys one, you know, whether it's James Bond or it's Fast and Furious or whatever the hell it is, you know, the different ones, there's pendulum swings and different things happen on different ones, and it's not like it's a plan. So, you know, what happens? And to that end, Fade to Black, you know, is great for showing you what can happen and the kinds of things that can happen.
Not to mention, you know, it's a snapshot of the time. I mean, someone else can write a book about, you know, some tent pole today, you know, but I mean, the 90s, I mean, that's like my favorite era for movies. So to have a snapshot of how, like, a 90s blockbuster was made, it's great.
You know? Yeah. Well, it's like reading Steve Poe's book, you know, the classic Making a Star Trek from the 60s. I mean, a lot of the stuff is still the same. It's just the budgets got bigger. You know, only, and then they output off their printer instead of typed it on a carbon copy Mimeo or something. But other than that, it's, you know, it's the emotions and the stresses and the budgets and the layers of bureaucracy and all that stuff doesn't change.
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much for talking to us about Michael Piller. What else have you got going on these days now that con season has ended?
Oh, well, thanks, guys. I hope we didn't talk a ton about individual seasons and shows, but I hope the broad strokes there
Hey, everyone has a copy of your book, right? They can fill in the gaps.
Yeah.
For Next Gen and then, you know, in DS9 and Voyager. There's so many good, you know, there's a lot of good writing and a lot of good podcast guests and all that, but yeah, hopefully that kind of I find myself more and more connecting dots. So, you know, not so much the nth details, but the dots. So, So one of the things, the big new thing, we just brought out a new, I think I mentioned it, the new Trekland on Speaker CD this year is for the 20th anniversary of Caretaker. So it's got Jerry and late great Rick Colby and Richard James, who was a production designer for Voyager, and Dan Curry, visual effects. So all their 94, 95 interviews with me, big chunks again. And that's at LarryNemechek.com where Trekland blog is and everything else. And like everybody else, we're all looking forward to the big 5-0 next year and crazy Vegas being 5 days long and the Geek Nation tours, the LA to Vegas Trek tour that Terrace does that he has me lead. We've already got 16 people on that already to max out at 35, and which will be next year. And we're adding the San Fran leg. So, you know, come to my site and that stuff's all there. But the big, 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 huge new thing, Trekland Trunk, I'll mention that real quick, and Enterprise in Space, the space nonprofit I'm involved with to put student experiments into orbit in 5 years. That's all exciting stuff. And the new thing that's the Summer Cons brought out was my new deep dive fan experience called Portal 47, which I know is not for everybody, but if you enjoyed making deep dives like this and hearing from new voices that you won't hear at conventions and maybe even on some podcasts, and seeing some more stuff out of my archives, I just invite everybody to do that. It's just a small, I say small, it'd be nice to have 50 to 100 people, but it's not about masses and masses of people. So it's just finally something I've been trying to do to get my memories and archives and my Rolodex of Trek people out in an all new way. So it's like a 24th century backstage pass to a 21st century way to get back to the 24th century, like a mini con all year long. So even for people that are isolated out in the middle of nowhere that never get to go to a convention, it'll hopefully feel like we'll bring some voices, my voice and some other voices and some of the things out of my archives to people. And all I'm saying right now is there is a Facebook page up, but for right now, it's kind of person-to-person setting up. So just email me, Larry@LarryNemechek.com, and which is my basic email, and just mention Portal 47, and I'll send you the info right now. Probably be another month or so before we go. But we're launching in September, and I've been signing people up one-to-one. And it's pretty exciting. It's something I've been trying to figure out how to do for 4, 5, 6 years. And on top of everything else. Stellar cartography and Star Trek Continues and crazy things interrupting my path. And but you're talking about a legacy. That's like one of the things I've really... I opened up a box today and I was looking for that pillar memo. And I found a thing where Bob Gillen on DS9 emailed Janet when they were still on Voyager, like midway on Voyager, and they were trying to get something to somebody's printer that would work in the office, and it was like Jerry Ryan's IMDb with her two credits when they were just had hired her, and they were trying to figure out what she'd been on already to get. I was like, oh, okay. It's like, can you print this out? And it had like dark skies and some like one guest shot on something from May 30th, 1997. But I've got like junk like that put back in files here and way more cooler stuff than that. But I just, that's kind of like what I need to, aside from all the other cool stuff that's going on right now. I don't want to be just a dusty guy from the past, but he said, wondering what the Star Trek Beyond is going to bring. For good and bad, but I just realized I have a calling to get that stuff out and get it aired out and get it preserved and share that with everybody. So that's what I'm focusing on now, apart from everything else, apart from everything else I'm already doing. So
excellent,
yeah. But thanks for asking, as always.
No. Yeah, thanks for taking the time to talk to us and everything. I mean, people love it when you come on our show.
They do.
And
they
it's
do.
Like, if there's one person who we were going to talk to you about, it had to be Michael Piller, right? I mean,
yeah.
He's like the guy. So
Michael was always very honest, and he would be busy, but when we did sit down to talk, he was when I was a first-timer out from Oklahoma to work on the book, I mean, nobody could talk to me when I first came out, like in '92. But they all called me back. Jerry and Michael and Rick and Brannon of the younger writers was the only one who called me back, which was plenty that I had to do in 3 months, the first edition, and then was very gracious after that, both when I was a visitor and then when we were around, when Janet worked right there and we were, in the Star Trek family there with the website and Communicator magazine and everything and. Was always very blunt and honest, and like I said, that last interview, even more so. And he was not a flashy guy. He didn't like taking, I said, well, the guy who saved Star Trek, and he's like, I wouldn't say that. I just tried to do, I just tried to do this, and I just tried to do that, and just tried to do that. So he was a really down-to-earth guy, and he says he wasn't a partier, he wasn't a Hollywood party guy, he just liked to go home to his family. And he was very big on writers having real life, not just watching TV and retreading what they saw on TV into their writing because they had such empty little lives because they sat at a desk all day. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. Or if they were young, to hurry up and make up for some, it's okay to be a young writer, but you just make sure you're having some life along the way. And anyway.
Thank you.
Sure thing.
Yeah, and we look forward to talking to you again soon.
Okay, guys, thanks.
Well, that was a lot of fun talking to Larry today. I mean, he's always a good guest to have, and I mean, it really was kind of like, okay, so he's the next gen guy, and Michael Piller is the next gen guy, so it's like we have to talk to Larry about Michael Piller. I mean, that's just like the natural thing, right?
Yeah, and it's so much fun. You can tell it's always fun talking to Larry because he has such a passion for it, and it's just you can just sit back and he has so much knowledge in there, and it's so much fun to have him share it.
Yeah, and it sounds like Michael Piller was really like a great guy in general,
Yeah.
I mean, it's not every time you hear anyone talk to him, talk about him, it's always like with, the utmost respect, I mean,
yeah.
Like Iris Stephen Bear, is always, sort of like bending over backwards to give him credit for what he brought to Star Trek and Deep Space Nine in particular and everything like that. And it's, it's one of those things. And I think it really kind of, the fact that everyone like feels the need to do that really kind of, I think, speaks to the type of person that he was. It's kind of cool,
Yeah, it is. You're right. Yeah.
Well, Michael Piller isn't the only thing we've been talking about this week on Trek FM. So here's a look at what you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
Well, it's very small and intimate, and you get to see, you know, a lot of people whose work you've come to admire or whatever. And I mean, that's what's kind of cool about it. The fact that it's in a hotel, it's at the Rio, and, you know, everyone is staying there.
Earl Grey.
Yeah, really, she's following the Hasbrat, I think, is really what it is.
Come for the revolution, stay for the Hasbrat.
It's got to be fresh Hasbrat. None of that replicated stuff.
Like, Daniel's like, at the watching the end of this episode, like, tears are coming down the face. It's like, oh, it's the Hasbrat. It's so spicy. It's what it is.
The Orb.
Also, the original title of this episode was A Matter of Breeding, which, when we talk about things feeling TNG-ish, that could have been a Riker episode.
The Ready Room.
It's about people and feelings and emotions. It's about philosophy. It's about the future. It's about hope. It's about glory. It's about intellectual promise. That's what Axanar is about. It is not a story about pew, pew, pew. I promise you that.
To the journey! I do have one honorable mention.
Name it.
Prax!
Oh, how could we not have a top five season five moments without Prax?
Warp 5.
It kind of like is akin to when fans saw the Galaxy class in The Next Generation for the very first time, and you had basically a crew and civilian complement of what, over 1,000 people. About 2/3 of that complement were civilians and their families. So you actually did have teachers and scholars and scientists and their extended families on board.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
One of the things that amazes me about the score for Star Trek The Motion Picture is that he only had 50% of the movie available to him when he scored. So he was scoring an awful lot to scene missing, scene missing.
The 602 Club.
Where did he get the cloak from on the other planet? I really, really, really want to know. He shows up with the cloak.
He kind of fashioned it out of a rudimentary lathe.
Literary Treks.
It's a small point, but I thought it was really interesting to have here in the book because, again, that's what Star Trek Deep Space Nine has really always done for Star Trek, which is kind of make faith okay in the Star Trek universe and show how it's valid. And so I thought that was a really nice, it's a tiny point in the book, but I thought it was pretty powerful, at least for me, who is somebody who is of faith. So
Axanar, the official podcast.
It is the spirit of TOS that matters that's being captured, but it doesn't necessarily have to be the aesthetic. The aesthetic was 1966 to 1969 that had its moment, that had its time, and there's a certain amount of charm still to that, but it doesn't allow you to push the
women
narrative forward because that type of aesthetic holds creativity back, in my opinion.
Keiko could totally beat the crap out of Rumpelstiltskin. This is so, like, I cannot buy this at all. That she's just sitting there being like, oh, my baby.
At the very least, she could throw a plant at him or something. Because we established in TNG that pot foo is a thing.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe. And beyond. Like... those new Star Trek Beyond uniforms. You see those things?
Yeah, I did see those. They're pretty, pretty good. The production quality is pretty solid. A lot of green.
I like the jacket.
Yeah.
And the new uniform. Did you see like Zachary Quinto like totally like, not, you know,
yeah.
Just throws out the new uniform and no one notices because, you know, he's all stealth about it.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know how much I like the new uniforms. I like the underarm like gusset thingies, and I like the kind of squared off shoulders.
Yeah,
but I don't like the fact that the little pattern is gone, and I don't know how much I like the collar. I don't know.
You know what? I am glad. To me, it's a sign that they're willing to put their own stamp. It's almost like a. Like Rathacon feel, where it's like we're going to put our own visual stamp on this, and it's going to work.
This is true, yeah. Sanya Milkovic Hayes is the costume designer. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right.
I don't know.
But
either.
She's done a million and one movies, including like all of the Fast and Furious movies and stuff like that. So she's
brought over a whole lot of people with him. We've talked about it. It's wonderful because he can communicate with them so easily. I think that's great.
Yeah, it's his team. She is also, by the way, the costume designer on Star Trek Insurrection.
No kidding.
Yes.
Well, the uniforms were pretty solid in that, as were the other costumes.
Mm-hmm.
So that there was nothing visually wrong with Insurrection.
No. Aside from that set where they didn't put in the special effects.
Well... Okay, I didn't say it was perfect.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
So, you know.
What can you do? So yeah, you'll find our shows wherever you get your Star Trek podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button. That helps us out greatly and makes it easier for other listeners to find the show as they search iTunes. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website and grab the RSS link as well. Another way that you can help keep all of our shows coming to you each week is to become a patron of the network on Patreon. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you'll find our current goals and different milestone contribution levels along with all the great perks we have for you. These perks include early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, seats on our content development team, and more. We really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. Yeah, you know, right now, as we speak, all of the patrons are having the patron roundtable discussion.
Yes.
Where they're talking about Star Trek community, like...
Yeah.
I don't know what they're talking about. Go listen to the thing. You can listen to the thing and see all the fun that they're having. And, you know, we would be there. We would be there, but we're here. Sorry.
Hey, you know what? We are bringing you more to talk about at the next roundtable.
There you go. There you go. That's good. All right. If you want to contact us, one way that you can do so is by leaving us a review on iTunes. That helps us out a lot. Apparently, like we were saying before, I guess I was not aware how much it helps us out, but it helps us out a lot.
Yep.
And we'll read it on the air, you know?
In a character voice of your choosing. Go ahead and let us know.
Yeah, yeah. And we would definitely appreciate iTunes reviews, because by doing that, we get moved up in the iTunes rankings, and then more people can find us easier and then listen to us, and then they can leave reviews, and then we get pushed up even higher, and then they leave reviews. Yeah. You get the idea. But there's other ways that you can contact us too, like if you want to get more specific or whatever. You can fill out the form on trekfm/contact, or you can leave us a voicemail if you look on the sidebar of the show page, or go to speakpipe.com/trekfm. Or you can find the network on Twitter at TrekFM, or the network on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM. And you can also find the Babel Conference on Facebook. If you just type the Babel Conference, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, or go to our website at trek.fm and click the discussion tab on the menu bar. You can also get there that way. And that's where all of the listeners discuss Star Trek and TrekFM and all sorts of fun stuff.
Yeah, Babel Conference is a lot of fun. It really is.
Yeah. I mean, it's and also a good place for Star Trek news, because if anybody sees anything related to Star Trek, it gets posted in the Babel Conference instantaneously.
It does. So
that comes in handy, for sure. Where can people find you, John?
Well, you can find me crawling around on Twitter at Kessel Junkie, KESSELJUNKIE. You can find me on my own little corner of the net at KesselJunkie.com. And you can also find me on a weekly podcast known as Words with Nerds, which is also available through iTunes and Stitcher and a couple other avenues. And would love to have you lend your ears over there as well.
Yeah. And your reviews.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I'll settle for ears at this point. That'd okay. be great.
All right. That's yeah. cool.
Where can they yes. find you, Mike?
Well, you can find me right here on Trek FM doing Standard Orbit with Drew. This week we talked to John Tenuto about the making of Star Trek VI. Yes. If you want to know what the best part of the Vegas convention was, just listen to this week's Standard Orbit, and that's the audio version of the best part of the Vegas convention for all practical purposes. Definitely check that out. And you can also find me on CommentaryTrackStars.com, where I do Commentary Trackstars Off Topic and Commentary Trackstar Babies. And by the way, I'm going to give a plug to this because I don't think anyone is going to listen / watch this, but I'm like 20 episodes behind on Commentary Trackstar Babies, where we do audio commentaries for TV shows.
Yeah.
So on Labor Day...
Yes.
I'm going to be doing a 15-hour podcasting marathon streaming live on Google Play / I guess YouTube. So if you want to see what's involved with the behind the scenes of that, and definitely check that out. There will be more details.
I will say that at the very least, tune in for hours 14 and 15 because that's going to get trippy.
It's going to be amazing. And, you know, if you happen to be free at any point on Labor Day, John, and there's a TV show that you want to talk about, let me know, you know, because I'll be around.
I will participate. You have thrown the gauntlet down. This will happen.
Excellent. Excellent. I appreciate it. So, yeah, there's that. And then you can also find me on Twitter at Mumbles3K, and you can find us on Twitter at ComTrackStars, or you can email us at ComTrackStars@gmail.com if you want to contact us directly, super directly. Before we go, we'd like to ask everyone to please support our sponsor, who helps us bring Commentary, Trek Stars, and all of our shows to you each week. And our sponsor for this show is Audible.com. Audible is a great way for you to read all the books you've always wanted to read, but never thought you'd have the time for, because you keep on messing up your copy. But John, what book do you have?
Well, the delightful choice for this week is the audio adaptation of Star Trek Insurrection, written by J.M. Dillard, obviously adapted from the script, and narrated by Boyd Gaines. And the description goes thus. The battle for paradise has begun. Starfleet has discovered a secret that could transform the future of the entire Federation, a secret that presents Picard and his crew with an agonizing moral dilemma. Faced with orders he cannot obey and a crisis he cannot ignore, Picard finds himself torn between his conscience and his uniform.
Did you see this movie in the theater?
I did.
You remember seeing it?
I do.
Yeah.
Yes.
What was it? Was it like opening night or what?
Yes, I saw opening night. I did. I saw it opening night in the movie theater. If I recall correctly, it was a 12:01 a.m. showing. Actually,
wow, they did not do that in Chicago back then.
They, I was hanging out in a college town back then, so midnight showings were quite the thing. Saw a lot of midnight showings, and this was one of them.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I did not. I see, and this shows my waning interest in Star Trek in the late 90s. Is like, I actually waited until the next day to see it. I didn't see it until Saturday. I went to 600 North Michigan after my space exploration class, and everyone in my space exploration class was like, "You guys going to see Star Trek? Oh, yeah.
Yeah."
And I remember going and thinking, yeah, it was okay.
I remember the distinct reaction of just about everybody in my row, because it was a whole bunch of us that went. At the end of it, as the credits are rolling, just one after another, we all just looked up and we just went, huh, okay. Yeah. And that was about, although I will I will say that seeing it in the movie theater, there was that one shot of them rowing across the water with the mountain in the background. Mm-hmm. And that has always stuck with me. That was one of the most gorgeous shots I had seen on screen up to that point. And I still maintain it's a beautiful shot.
Yeah. 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 I mean, it's a good looking movie, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, it's cool. But yeah, I mean, if you want to sort of get an idea of why it may not have blown you away, definitely check out Michael Piller's book because
yes.
It's a fascinating read. It's a fascinating read. All right. Well, you can get Insurrection for free on Audible since you're a Trek FM listener. As a Trek FM listener, you can get a free audiobook of your choice along with the 30-day trial to see just how great Audible is. Just go to audibletrial.com/TrekFM and sign up today. Again, that's audibletrial.com. And we thank Audible for supporting Commentary, Trek Stars, and the network. All right. So that takes care of Michael Piller's work on Star Trek. Very, very vast. I mean, he's definitely up there as one of the absolute most important creators in Star Trek history.
And possibly in the recent television history, considering how many careers he launched.
Yeah.
Or helped launch, I should say.
That's definitely true, yeah. Yeah. And we'll be back next week to take a look at his first non-Star Trek show, Legend.